Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook/The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter @The Kick-Ass Life, and of course, at thekickasslife.com.
Hey, this is Pat Flynn from Smart Passive Income, and you're listening to David Wood on The Kick-Ass Life Show.
Want to make your life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Hello, welcome to the Kick-Ass Life. It is once again Michael O'Neill stepping in for the Africa-bound David Wood. David and Jen and team have summited Kilimanjaro. They're back down. Everybody's safe and sound. So check that off the bucket list. And now they're on a safari. That's what they're doing now for a couple of days. And then we'll be back. I think next Tuesday will be, maybe Thursday. I'm not sure. He might surprise me. But should be the next David Wood show. And I hope you guys loved John Assaraf the other day. John was unbelievable, and he stepped up and excuse me, and really did an unbelievable job with the show. Of course, he's a master. I mean, the guy's a master trainer, and he was really cool on short notice to come in and give us 30 minutes of his time. So I'm not going to step on the show too much. I'm just going to make sure you guys go to the right places. When you want to find out anything about this next guest, all you have to do is go to thekickasslife.com/85. So that's going to be our new naming convention. So it'll be a lot easier for us to share the show notes with all of you. Often we have links and links to books and websites and Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts and everything that are in the show notes on the kickasslife.com website. So we want to make sure you see all that stuff. And if they have some really cool book or a free link for you, that you can get to it. So in this case, it's going to be show number 85. And today's guest is an unbelievable woman. Her name is Gloria Loring. And you may not have heard of Gloria, or maybe you have. She is a singer and an actress. In fact, if you are a soap opera fan, she was a woman called Liz Chandler on Days of Our Lives. And she also composed the theme to Different Strokes and The Facts of Life. You take the good, you take the bad. So really cool. But she's also the mother of Robin Thicke, R&B super singer, and the ex-wife of Alan Thicke, who you, I'm sure, all saw in the 80s. So she spends her life now performing and has wonderful connections to a number of charities, and wrote a really great book called Coincidence is God's Way of Remaining Anonymous. So, without further ado, this is David with Gloria Loring.
So, as I always start the show, I always start the same way, how incredibly excited I am. And, you know, the show, The Kick-Ass Life, is all about that beautiful, authentic range. And my guest today, even in our first conversation, I had this wonderful sense of authenticity and just inner light and inner beauty. So I'm so excited. And because she's a recording artist, I thought what I'd do is I'm going to start by playing, before I introduce her, I'm going to start by playing one of her songs. Listen to this. Some of you know this. Some of you need to get to iTunes and get this. I can hear her laughing in the background. She can't hear what I'm doing here. So, all right. So, with that said, I have the great honor of having a wonderful conversation with somebody who really, again, this personal range is just so wonderful and evident in everything she does. So, Gloria, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David.
You know, I was looking through everything you've accomplished, and I'm actually come to the conclusion you're twins. But you know, with such a, I mean, you know, you've graced stages around the world, and whether it's as an author, as a performing star, as an actress, I mean, in so many genres, you've sort of reached the highest levels. You've worked with some of the great minds and great artists of the world. How does it all feel? Do you wake up in the morning and still put your feet in your slippers and feel just the same, or has it changed you in any way? What's going on for you?
Has it changed me? Yes, of course, life changes us. It softens our edges. If we're paying attention and if we're truly fortunate, it helps us understand more deeply who we are and what our contribution maybe has been and can be going forward and is right now. Has my life changed since I was a teenager striving to be acknowledged and valued and loved and adored? Growing up in an alcoholic family where there was inappropriate sexual contact with my father and all of these things that were subconscious, what I call drivers, you know, driving me to be successful, to be pretty. I think the hardest thing for me was back then, and for so much of my life, I was one person on stage and another person off stage. I was very confident. I was very, now I need this, and you need to do this now. And I was even bossy at times, I'm sure. But off stage, I didn't know, you know, where I was in relationship to other people. I either did too much or did too little. And it really was what I trace in my book, Coincidence is God's Way of Remaining Anonymous. It was a series of unfoldings of coinciding of meaningful events for me that helped me integrate my inner life and my outer life and to become one person, the same person off stage as I am on stage. And that's a very big relief, believe me.
Well, you know, one of the things I know you don't, we haven't worked together personally, but, you know, one of the things I'm really, I strive for, and I train a lot of trainers, is that real thing where they can be themselves on stage, where they can show up in all of their idiosyncrasies there, and that authenticity piece. Do you notice, because you work with so many stars, I mean, that it's very, very easy for somebody who's in the spotlight to have that duality, to have that sort of two-person thing going on?
Well, it may be that very often, I can't speak for anybody else truly, but it may be that so many of us, and having read, you know, biographies here and there, so many of us went into the show business to show ourselves, to try to have a greater sense of perhaps value. I mean, some people knew who they were and are very strong, but some of us needed to have an outward approval, an outward reinforcement. I mean, I think we all do to
great. Yeah, I think we all do too, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's certainly possible. I don't know everybody, so I can't speak for them all.
Yeah, there was a, you know, so when we look at your story, this evolving story, you go back to the time when you were a little girl and, you know, growing up in a house that was very toxic, and you talked about, you know, this relationship with your father. You know, can you take us back to this time? Were you already dreaming, and did you already have this idea that you would actually end up on stage singing? Was that something that was already with you when you were very young?
So a couple things. One is that, you know, the minute somebody, I just want to go back and just address something that was in that flow that you just gave me. My childhood was not very toxic. My childhood had great gifts and great happiness and blessings, the good and the not so good. My father's alcoholism certainly colored many things, but I don't blame anybody, but going back to as a young child, I mean, I take everybody has their responsibility, let me just say that. So going back to my life as a young child, what I remember most is that whenever I sang, people applauded and they paid attention, and I loved to sing. It felt good. It feels good. And so I found my way to be special by singing. And it was just a natural thing. In the same way that my son, Robin Thicke, who's a, you know, big R&B star and has Grammy certificates and all of that stuff, you know, he just started singing as a young boy. It just came out of him. It was a natural expression for him. And by the time he was 14, 15, he was singing in a group and writing songs and all of that. So it was natural for me to do that. Did I have an idea of it? I do remember as a child thinking I would either be a teacher or a singer, just as long as I was at the front of the room.
I love it. And so, you know, if you come to this moment, we're talking about your book, Coincidence is God's Ways of Remaining Anonymous, which, by the way, I absolutely love this title. It's so great.
Albert Einstein for that.
Yeah, exactly. What is the coincidences that you, when you go back to that early time, can you share some of those moments of these crossroads you've hit? And by the way, I love the way you preface what happened with your family. And I do apologize by me using that term just in your opening when you talked about that. But I love the fact that, you know, within every family structure, within every experience is that light. And if there is darkness or if there is anything going on, if we have the ability to walk in the light, those things can serve us in so many ways. So I really love the preface you put around that. But so take us back to some of these coincidences and sort of how this led to you writing this book.
Well, the coincidences that led me to this book started when I was on Days of Our Lives just about 30 years ago. And my little son, Brennan, who is now quite an adult, was diagnosed with diabetes at age 4.5. And along the way, in that first year, he asked me, "Mama, when are my shots going to be over?" And of course, I couldn't say never. So I said, "Well, I don't know, honey, but we're working on it." See, I had joined the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation along with my husband, Alan Thicke, the Canadian.
Canuck.
Hey, Canada. Anyway, we had joined and we were looking at things that we could do to help them because we were both celebrities, etc. And he did a project with the hockey players and made a record and made about $60,000. And that really inspired me. And I thought, well, I'm going to look for an opportunity to raise money somehow for diabetes research. And then I joined Days of Our Lives and I noticed the actors traded recipes. And I decided to create this Days of Our Lives celebrity cookbook. And fast forward almost a year, I had everything ready to go. And people who would help advertise it, everything for free, except I had to raise $40,000 to print the first 50,000 copies of the book. Because remember, Days of Our Lives back then had 10 million daily viewers. So I had a good chance of raising quite a bit of money. And I came into Days of Our Lives, it was on a Friday. And I did my day's work. And at the end of the day, I picked up my carry bag that I had put on the chair in the morning. And underneath there was a little card that said, "Expect a miracle."
Mm.
Now, that night, I got on a plane to Houston. And 24 hours later, I met the man who helped me underwrite the cookbook, pay for the printing, 24 hours after the Expect a Miracle card showed up. Now, at the time, I didn't have a framework or an understanding, spiritual or otherwise, to hold this idea of this thing showing up in my dressing room, this mystery, which, by the way, has never been solved. I do not know who put it in my dressing room. So I just kind of tossed it off and I've said, "Well, that's an amazing coincidence." And along the way, someone like you, an interviewer, said, "Yes, but you know, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous." And I said, wait a minute. Let me write that down. Tell me that coincidence is what? God's way of remaining anonymous. It was like a big question mark. But I started to think about it. And every time I told the story of how the Days of Our Lives celebrity cookbooks raised $1 million for diabetes research and the little card that said, "Expect a miracle," I would button the story with, "And you know, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous," thinking myself very cool and smart, although I had no idea what I was saying. And it was as those years went on after that cookbook, I started to see that there were some extraordinary coincidences, meaningful coincidings coming into my life of the right people, the right words, the right opportunities presenting themselves just when I seemed to need them most. And I had this big basket called Coincidence is God's Way of Remaining Anonymous, with big overarching view within which now to hold this. And so at one point, quite a few years ago, more than 12 years ago, I sat down and I started to write the stories down, just my stories. And then I thought, well, this isn't enough for people, you know, because I don't want people to think, well, oh, look, she's so lucky, because it's not that. This works for all of us. It's like gravity. You know, you don't need to believe in God or some supreme power. Gravity exists. You don't need to call its name. It just is. And the magnificent creativity and intelligence that created our bodies, our lives, this earth, this one of many billions of universes, also works in our behalf. Andrew Weil said, mystics, the ones who delve into the mysteries, mystics believe there is a conspiracy in the universe on their behalf. Mm. And I love that. And that's how I live my life. So has all of this changed me? Oh, you betcha.
So go back then. Your relationship with God, I mean, just was that always evident? I mean, is it something that's it's opening more? Or was it something as a little girl you kind of had that relationship?
I had inklings of it, feelings of it a few times. But I put all that aside because I just couldn't buy into that some people had it right and everybody else had it wrong. And that's sort of the way I was raised. And I detail that in the book. I just thought that if we're all created in the image of the Most High, then that means we all must have access to that. And maybe our understanding won't be perfected yet. And maybe the people who think they're most right will wind up being most mistaken. I don't know. It's not for me to say. But I did read a lot. I read about the Baha'i faith. I read about, I read the Bhagavad Gita. I went and took yoga classes and delved a little into the viewpoint of yoga, yoga philosophy. But I didn't think I was going to ever find a place or an understanding that would be ecumenical enough for my heart. And again, coincidence is God's way. This book is very ecumenically inclusive, and my Christian friend said, well, that's good, because I think God is very ecumenically inclusive. And
I love that word, by the way, ecumenically. I love it. I don't hear it used ever, so it's awesome. Carry on.
So I wanted this, and I detail this in my book, of course. That's what this book is about. I got to a point where I wanted to pray. I felt like I had lost touch with why I should be in the world. I cried every day for 4 months. I thought I couldn't sing anymore. I wouldn't sing because I realized I had been using people with my singing to love me. Trying to make them love me with my singing, and I knew that that wasn't a good enough reason to sing any longer. And if I wasn't a singer, who was I? I didn't know. And I cried every day for 4 months. And I got to a point, it was in December, and I remember sending what I didn't realize at the time was a kind of little prayer up into the ether saying, I want to know how to pray. I want to know how to contact you, with a capital Y. But I didn't believe what I'd been taught as a child. I didn't believe in what I had absorbed in my own childish way of some guy sitting on a throne saying, you die, you live, you get a hurricane, you get a tornado, you get a car crash. I just didn't buy that. There's something much bigger. And for me, I was sent the perfect study course. It was a correspondence course in yoga philosophy that someone I knew decided to gift me with for a year. And every time I read the lessons, I felt so good. And they spoke in very general terms. They didn't ask me to believe anything. If anything, they said, you will come to know what is true by your own experience. You see, and that's what I call EBL, evidence-based living. Once we have a bigger view to attend to, like coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous, or all things work together for good, if we get a big overarching view, then we can start to see how that works in our lives, because we will find what we look for. If we look for nastiness and cynicism and revenge and lack of forgiveness, we will find that. Trust me, you will find it. When we start to look for the good, and I call it looking for the good. I have a blog called Looking for the Good. When we start looking for the good, we will find that. It says, we're told in so many different ways, as you think, so you become. So for me, it was a process of study, contemplation, meditation, getting past the negative mind, because the mind can be very negative. Mine not especially, but certainly. Once I got deeper than that, I found a place of peace. And I found that the love that I wanted was actually inside me, that I contained it. And I don't just believe this. I've had profound experiences of it. And I talk about those in the book, where the love just poured up from inside me for no reason. Nobody was saying, oh, Gloria, you're just fabulous. I just love you. And you're so kind and you're so good. And you're so, nobody was saying nothing to me. I was sitting in a room with 5,000 people, sitting there meditating in the dark, and the love poured up like a jet engine from within me. And filled my heart and filled my eyes. And I went, oh, my God. It's not just that I have access to the love. I am the love somehow. And you see, this correlates with what the great beings and saints of traditions, many traditions, have talked about. That ecstatic moment when they realize they are connected to the all, to the I am that I am. To that ground of being that is consciousness and bliss. And so I had those experiences. And now I say to people, go out in the world and find, look for the good. Look at how coincidence brings you what you need to know and what you need to grow beyond any current limitations you believe about yourself. Coincidence will reflect back to you what you are putting out in the world. If you have a bunch of angry people in your life, it's a good probability you either believe you're supposed to have anger in your life, or you have anger within you that you have not yet gotten up and out. You know, clear the blockage. It's like a beaver dam that's been created in the flow of energy within us. And I had the opportunity to do that kind of healing work. And so this book is about each of us finding our own path in our own way, because coincidence, that is the evidence of the Most High, of the great, magnificent love and harmony and creativity and intelligence that created this universe, it will come into our lives and tell us exactly what is right for us. But we have to be ready to pay attention.
Well, you know what? I mean, so many things I want to ask you about in what you just shared, and so beautiful. Going back, though, to this time, days in your life, this coincident, this little note, and then this journey starts where, you know, you start to become aware of these coincidences and the role they play. You start to walk hand in hand with your creator in many, many ways, but this sort of, you start to see the world differently. You know, so many people aren't aware. So many people, you know, when they're sort of, they say the first big step in change is awareness. And I think so much of what you've said is sort of, for many people, it's sort of an opening door. But how long after this first coincidence was it before you started to feel this authentic person who was the same on stage and the same off stage, and you started to sort of have that sense of deep self-love? Was that a journey of years? Was that a journey of months? Give me some time frames on this.
Years. It takes so much effort, and we keep going. You know, there's always one more layer to shed. There's one more unfortunate idea that comes up that brings tears to our eyes, that tells us we're not good enough in some way, that separates. You see, these unfortunate ideas that we have, we call them personal myths in psychology, they separate us from goodness. And certainly, so many of our religious leaders have told us that we are basically flawed. And yet we're told also that we're created in the image of the Most High. So how do I reconcile that? Is the flaw the fact that I make mistakes about myself? Yes, I forget who I am. We forget that we have within us, we're told that the kingdom of heaven is within. Well, hello, that means we're walking around with the supreme beingness right inside us. And it's our true self. And so we lose touch with it. Yeah, that's an error. That's a mistake. Eric Butterworth said that sin is self-inflicted nonsense. Nonsensical. And we inflict it on ourselves that we are not good enough. We are basically flawed. We can never be saved without doing and saying and pranaming or bowing or whatever, or doing certain things. We, you know, it's like, you know, that which created us is love itself. And so our job is to come back to the love itself.
Mm. When we use the word God and love, do you see them as a synonymous thing? Is it one thing to you? Is love the answer? I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm asking the question. But do you feel that love is the answer?
You know what's funny? I have a song that I just recorded called Love is the Answer. Yeah. I am in chapter 12 of my book. I talk about the concept that I read years ago, that there are only two choices. There's fear or love. And, you know, fear is hatred, defensiveness, revenge, lack of forgiveness, frustration, annoyance, you know. Those are all fear. Anger is fear. Always, we're angry because we're afraid that somebody is saying something bad about us, and it might be true. And so we react in anger. You know, it's like if somebody comes in the room and says to me, "Gloria, you're stupid." I wouldn't get angry. I would go like, "Well, there are a lot of things I am, but I'm not stupid." You know.
I love it. When you go back. If you go back again to when you were in your teens, and you know you were just starting to make your own way, and if you'd read your book back then, if you'd had this book in your hands, and you'd have been made aware of this ability to have that self-expression, that you know, love of self, and to really start to look for and see the light and beauty in everyone, to really understand the coincidences that are around us in every moment, and that they're there to serve us. And sometimes it's not the obvious road. Some coincidences take us somewhere where we don't think, because our mind's in the way, that's the direction. How would that book have helped you? Just give me an idea, because I can see, so I can hear. This show's in 154 countries now, and I can see people around the world. So I want to get this book, and I want to read this book. But what would you have done differently, knowing what you know now?
I don't know if I could have, if I would have absorbed it, because here's the deal. I think we're ready for the information when we're ready for the information. I read... scientific Christianity. I read Eric Butterworth. I read, what's his name? He did the Sermon on the Mount book. That was so wonderful. My dad, the alcoholic, who was also this brilliant man, was giving me yoga books. And I was reading books of scripture and all of this. And it was helping me, but I don't think we're ready to heal the deep places until we're ready to heal the deep places. Could it have been possibly instructive? Yes. But I still think my life would have unfolded the way it did, and I would have been ready for the deep healing when I was. But yes, I think that the sooner we can come across these ideas that, you see, we are a participant in our lives. Once we are willing to take responsibility, not blame, you know, put down the blame thrower as my away from the blame thrower. Once we're able to take responsibility for our participation in a relationship, in a difficult relationship, we know that women who are in abusive relationships, they hold an idea in themselves that they are supposed to be abused on some level. So there is a participation somehow. And I don't know, you know, I don't know exactly how it works. That's up to the biggest view of the whole universe. But there is a participation. And once we look at it, we can start to heal. We can forgive ourselves for being in the relationship, and perhaps we can forgive the person who did that or the circumstance, because, you know, we know forgiveness is so important, not because of what it does for the other person. My forgiving my father didn't do a darn thing for him, because I didn't come to that forgiveness until after he passed. But what it did was it healed me. And I never even told him what happened. He was profoundly drunk when he fell in bed on top of me when I was 3 years old. A part of my spirit shattered off, and I didn't bring it back to my body, to myself. I didn't restore myself to wholeness till I was in my 40s. But that's okay now. Because, you know, it's like, okay, you said you're going to be climbing Kilimanjaro.
That's right.
the journey is going to be very arduous at times. Sometimes the view is going to be magnificent and you're going to be exhilarated. And sometimes you might be retching, you know, over the side of the tent or something. You know, it's going to be a challenge. And when you complete it, as far as you go, you will say, it was worth getting to where I was able to get, to see what I saw, to understand my own limits, my own abilities. It will have been worth it. It will have been the experience of a lifetime. Well, my life is my experience of a lifetime.
Yeah, you know, I want to touch on a couple of things, because I mean, I think that so much of the work I do personally, and what I hear in your book, when I hear in your heart, this idea around forgiveness, there's a wonderful saying that says, you know, holding on to anger or hatred is like drinking poison and expecting somebody else to die. And I wonder, you know, if you can talk a little bit more about this forgiveness, because obviously, you know, there are so many people out there right now who are carrying this load of something that's happened to them, and it can be in the same circumstances as yourself. About 90% of my students are women, and I see this a lot. But how important is forgiveness, and how did you come to a place where forgiveness I can almost sense it in you, where you're able to let go now of things. I call it immediate forgiveness, where you get to a place in your life where you can forgive people more quickly, knowing that everyone's doing the best they can with what they have. I'm not saying that you can get walked over, but how important is forgiveness, and how do you get to a place, or how have you got to a place to be able to forgive?
Well, I use a technique that comes from Hawaii, from the great leaders of Hawaii. And I've forgotten what the name is. Hono something.
Oh, Ho'oponopono?
Yes. And the minute I want to blame someone for doing something, for being insensitive, for being in attack mode, for cutting me off, for whatever it is, the minute I feel hurt, I quickly think to myself, Gloria, have you ever done anything like this? And then, of course I have. Of course I have. I've been thoughtless. I've been hurtful. I've been unconscious. I've struck out at people. You know, maybe I never did anything like sexualized contact, but with a child. But were there other things that came out of my own hurt and rage? As a child, you know, things that happened to me. Well, things happened to my dad, you know. I mean, he lost his mother when he was 5 years old. And all three of the brothers wound up as alcoholics. And so there was this sensitivity. You know, when we're out of our head with alcohol, we don't know what we're doing. And when we're out of our head with out of our true selves, with unfortunate understandings, we sometimes strike out. We sometimes fall into places or on top of people that we shouldn't. And so I go to, have I ever done anything closely resembling that this in any way, shape, or form? And of course I always have. And so I say to myself, I'm very sorry. And I say to that person, I'm so sorry. And I say, I love you. And what Oprah says is true. If you knew better, you'd do better. And so I try to let go. And sometimes it takes me months. Happened this last year. My sister was dying, but none of us could voice that, but I knew it because she was living at my home. And certain things happened, and someone was very angry with me that I didn't show up for a certain thing in a certain way at a certain time. And I was in the middle of taking her to the hospital, but they still felt I should have showed up on time, et cetera, et cetera. And it's taken me months and months. I've forgiven, but it still comes back. And why does it hurt me? Because of this deep message in me that nothing I do is good enough, and no matter how hard I try, I will sooner or later screw up and disappoint people. And so here's this old message that is still there, and there's another layer of it to work on. So I try to, as you say, forgive myself as quickly as possible by forgiving the other person, and forgive the other person by forgiving myself.
That's so beautiful. And, you know, in the journey, and what I love about, you know, your message in that last statement was the idea that this is never, I mean, there's not like you get to a place where, hey, I'm fixed. It's not about fixing or anything. It's a question of that this is a constant challenge in our lives, is to be aware, to be conscious, to constantly re-fall in love with ourselves in the dark times, in the peaks and the valleys. And, you know, obviously it sounds to me like you've come to a place, and I can't wait to read the book. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm going to order it today. And I urge anyone listening to read this book, because what I love is the essence of you. Like I said, the very moment we started speaking, I had this deep sense. And I know I work with a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people a year. And there's this deep sense of what you're speaking is how you're living. This deep sense of just real, authentic, and just a caring heart. Do you find, as you look forward, with the knowledge you have right now and the awareness you have right now, what are some of the things you're looking forward to expressing in the coming years? Where's your mind going, or are you just here in the present right now and just see what happens?
Well, I'm trying to be in the present and not jump too far ahead, because of course there are always things you'd love to see happen that maybe haven't happened yet. And rather than try to focus on the fact that they haven't happened yet, I try to focus on what is happening now. But the things I want to do, I want to spend more time out in the world. I live up in the mountains, and my life here has been fairly quiet. I do go out and sing and speak now and then, but I want to be more in the world sharing this perspective, speaking, giving workshops, because I know when we tell the truth, when one of us tells the truth, we empower others to tell the truth. When one of us shares the way we got healed, we empower others to seek the ways that they might then be healed. And I think if there's anything that I feel strongly about, it's this end of the Mayan age, end of the Kali Yuga, the processional age, the 26,000 year time that supposedly ended in December 2012, that now we're going forward, and I believe we have an opportunity to shift things. I mean, look at the powerful things that happened in the last several years leading up to 2012. The explosion of the Arab Spring. Instead of us trying to inflict democracy on people in the way we wanted them to have it, they came up and said, no, we want this for ourselves and we'll find our way. Sandy Hook in the United States and the conversation. Finally, there's a breakthrough about, could we just be somewhat reasonable? Could we have a conversation about the way we are harming each other and how we could maybe diminish that? You know, I think there are these enormous opportunities coming, and I think they're here for each other too. In recent years, one of the reasons I finally finished my book, which took me 12 years to do, was because I was afraid of putting a book out that had God in the title, written by Gloria Loring. People would think, excuse me, she's not a theologian. She's not, you know, she's not a spiritual leader. But I finally realized that most of the books on the bestseller list in the nonfiction had something to do with spiritual life and spiritual understanding. So I think things are changing. Some of the leaders in these areas say that there's a new time coming, there's a new expansion of consciousness coming, that we can lift ourselves up a few notches on the power versus force scale. Dr. David Hawkins, you know, we can come to a new understanding, a new way of seeing each other. And I cherish the thought that my small healing as a part of the healing of the whole world will serve some purpose for that.
Awesome. When we took at some of the coincidences, I mean, we've got a few minutes left now on the show, but I'd like to go back to your book. And by the way, I totally agree. I mean, I think that anyone whose heart is open and can feel there's a sense of change, which I think is coming. And I think so many people I work in this arena have that same sense. And I think it's each of us, you used the word responsibility earlier. I think it's each of our responsibilities to step into that on our, you know, in our own way and affect our own world, whether it's a tiny world we live in, whether it's just our streets, you know, our own light can, I believe, have that impact. But if we go back to your coincidences, can you share a couple of the stories from your book to give us a little glimpse behind the cover and a few of the other things that have happened either to you or to some of the people that have contributed to the book?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, there was the little Expect a Miracle card that came just before I found the benefactor who helped me raise $1 million for diabetes research and keep the promise to my son. And then just a couple of years after that, I had told my husband, Alan Thick, that secretly, he was the only person who I discussed this with, that I wanted a separation. I needed time to think about how we could maybe go forward, although I knew in my heart that I was going to have to leave the marriage, that I needed to in order to continue growing. I did a lot of thought about that. And just about that time, within a couple of weeks, I received the first of 2.5 years of letters from a woman I had met briefly in Lincoln, Nebraska, who was a stranger to me, who had said when I met her and I was signing the cookbook for her, and she said, "I know about your son's diabetes, and I want you to know I will pray for you." Now, normally this was the kind of thing said to me that would have made me want to go, "Okay, fine, lady, please, you back off," you know. But she was so sincere and sweet. And now, several months later, just as I've privately told Alan I want a separation and I know I'm headed toward divorce, she writes me a letter and she says, "I hope this is not presumptuous, but I said I would pray for you and I have been, and I'm getting messages for you. I hope you don't mind, but I'm including the first message in this letter." And I read a message that started, "My daughter, do not be afraid. I am putting you on a new path. You will not be alone. I will be with you every step of the way." I started sobbing. I fell to my knees. The girl who felt so alone in the world, who thought that if she didn't do it, it didn't get done. You know, I love to try to control things, which, yeah, good luck on that. You know, I tried to make everything just right in my life. I was so terrified of not being good enough. I was so certain I was all alone and that no one understood me. And now this letter comes, and it broke something open in my heart. And thereafter, for 2.5 years, the exact time that it took for my divorce to finally become final, every month or two, a letter would arrive from Shirley Lemke in Lincoln, Nebraska, with further messages from God for little Gloria. And every one of them would just find tears streaming down my face. Such love, such magnificence. Now, it took me, I just accepted them. I thought, well, she's a woman who prays and she's making these things up or whatever, you know. And so I took them at face value. Wait a minute. I'm sorry.
Don't worry. Are you there? Well, we're just going to wait and see. I think that she just put this on mute while she's sorting with her dog. And we'll see if she comes
there?
Back. Oh, there you go. Yeah, I thought there. How are you?
Here I am. I'm back.
No worries.
So I took them at face value. Just, these are very compassionate letters from this woman in Lincoln, Nebraska. 14 years after the first letter arrived, I called her. And I said, "Shirley, I'm writing down these stories, and I'm including the letters you sent me, what I called the letters from God. And you know, it dawns on me, how silly, I never asked you why you wrote that first letter, how you started. I want to know from your perspective." And she said, "It's interesting you ask that." She said, "Because I was driving to my Bible study class that night. It was a Wednesday. And as I was driving, it was as if I stepped outside of time and space and entered this sort of suspended sense of everything. And a voice said to me, 'You must tell Gloria that I love her and she is not to worry. Everything will be all right.'" And she said, "I started to argue with the voice, saying, 'Lord, I don't know anyone named Gloria except that actress on Days of Our Lives. And where in the world am I going to come in contact with her?' And the voice said, 'Wait and see.'" And that night she went to her Bible study and they did their study, and they always had a quiet time, sort of a Quaker silence at the end, in case anyone felt prompted to say something. And as they were in the silence, one of the women in the study class spoke up and said, "I don't know why, but I'm being prompted to tell you that Gloria Loring is coming to the mall this weekend to sign her Days of Our Lives cookbook."
Wow.
And that's why that weekend, Shirley was there in front of me and handed me a letter and said, "I will pray for you." And the first letter was just about my son. And she said, "You are not alone anymore. I will pray for your son. You and I are in this together now." And I mean, that one made me cry. But then 2 months later, here I received this letter and she said, "I'm getting messages for you." And it started just after I asked my husband for a separation and ultimately divorce. And the letters stopped coming when the divorce became final, as if it was now complete and I had imbibed enough of this encouragement that I didn't need it to arrive in letters any longer. So I could have written a whole book just about those letters. They're just part of the unfolding of the things that came into my life that have led me to be able to speak with such deep, heartfelt conviction that coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. It is the way that the magnificence and connection, the connecting principle is what Carl Jung calls it, the way it comes to our lives and operates in our lives.
What do you say to someone right now? I can almost hear them, not a lot, but I can hear people who, like you in the beginning, would discount a story like that because, you know, and they're discounting other coincidences, the things that are happening around them every single moment. And I do believe that there's that moment. In fact, my last guest was swimming in the Olympics, and she talked about there were times in the pool where she felt that she was being lifted, or that she felt this presence with her, and it felt like she felt like she was a part of the water. And there was this definite knowing that she sort of had become a part of all things. It was a beautiful, beautiful story. But I wonder, what do you say to someone who's still struggling with this, you know, their wacky monkey brain? And I say that, I'm talking about the negative voice in our head, not the light voice in our head, but that negative voice in our head that's always sort of discounting and attempting to pull us back to what, you know, back to sort of the darker side, as it were. What do you say to someone when they're struggling with the concept? And they want to feel something. They want to have that sense that you have as you speak. There's that sense of deep love. There's that sense of buoyancy. There's that sense of wonder in your voice. There's that sense of wonder in the way you see the world. They want to feel that. What do you say to them? How do they get to that place?
Well, first of all, I would say to them that you are just fine right where you are. Wherever you are now is exactly where you're supposed to be now. And because the first thing is to love ourselves exactly as we are and accept ourselves exactly as we are, because I think the magnificence that created us does just that. If you find yourself drawn to a way of study, a person, a place, a thing, a project, see if you can trust your own inner sense. See if it leads you toward some goodness in your life. If it leads you toward the darkness, then you may have a belief in you that says, "I'm supposed to have darkness in my life." And it may be so deep-seated that you don't even understand it. I'll give you an example of that. I have a niece who had a series of very difficult relationships, people who betrayed her, disappointed her, nothing truly abusive, but just as if she was invisible and didn't count, you know, as if her needs or wants or her personage did not deserve any respect. And finally, she went to a therapist, and the therapist very wisely said to her, "Well, tell me what all these lousy boyfriends you've had have in common with each other." And my niece thought for a second, and then she said, little, you know, light bulb over the head, said, "Oh, me." And the therapist said, "Yes. So what is it about you that thinks you deserve lousy boyfriends?" Well, of course, how simple. Both her parents were alcoholics. They constantly disappointed her. They constantly said they'd do something, and then they couldn't because they were drunk. She was going to be in the Junior Olympics and had a beautiful horse. She'd been accepted. I mean, this was ecstatic material for her life, for her inner sense of being. She came home one day, and her parents had sold her horse out from under her, because they needed the money for their bills. They didn't ask. They didn't discuss. They didn't nothing. They took, like she was invisible, like there was no reason to respect her needs, her wants in life. And so, I mean, I actually get shivers in me when I think about the profound betrayal. And of course, she kept repeating that betrayal because she hadn't yet brought it to consciousness. I'm trying to remember who said this because I quoted in my book. It might be someone like Carl Jung or someone like that, but he said, you know, bringing the darkness into the light is something that not many of us want to take the time to do because it takes a whole lot. I'm paraphrasing, and there's so many lovely distractions along the way.
Yeah.
There are games to play and movies to see and friends to go out with, but ultimately it's we who live in the darkness or bring ourselves into the light, and we will get feedback from the world around us telling us whether we are dwelling more in the dark or whether we're moving toward the light. We can tell by the people we attract, by our thoughts. Do we think things? I used to think things like, oh, just my luck. What was I saying? Excuse me, that I always had bad luck? Oh, please, my life has been filled with magnificence and fortunate occurrences. And yet, listen to what I was repeating. So it's coming to consciousness and becoming aware. What are we attracting and what are we running from?
Awesome. You know, it's so beautiful. That's such a wonderful way because we're at the end of the show. But I want to ask you one last question. The show's called The Kick-Ass Life, and it's a little edgy. And obviously, like I said, you know, it's reached its arms around the world, and I'm so grateful. And attracting so many beautiful souls like yourself who come and share their wisdoms and their journey. What does it mean for you to lead a kick-ass life? How would you describe that? What is a kick-ass life?
Love that. Kick-ass life. The first thing that comes into mind is to give a kick in the ass to anything that steps into my life that spoils my peace. My number one priority in life is peace. Peace of mind, peace of heart, peace in my physical being. To be willing to take on anything that comes, knowing I am big enough to hold it now. I used to be so afraid of confrontation. I used to be so afraid of disappointing people. And I know now that in truth, and with maybe a capital T, I am big enough to hold any and all events that come into my life. I was big enough. My spirit is large enough now. My sense of my spirit was always large enough. My sense of my spirit, my foundational being, was big enough to hold the passing of my sister 8 months ago, to have her in my home for her last 6 weeks, to be able to not go into, you know, profound lost in it grief, but to see the good in every moment we had together, to cherish the good. My spirit is my sense of my spirit is bigger now, so I can hold things. I can hold my own death. I think I can. I think I can when it comes. I think I will be ready. And that's a big thing, not to be afraid to die, because then I'm more afraid to take each day of my life as it comes. So the kick-ass life, yeah, to kick anything, kick it in the ass. If it comes along, it's into my path and tries to threaten my joy of heart and my peace of mind, that I know now I have the strength to give it a good swift one.
You know, what's really funny is the only other person, I've had 100 shows, and the only other person that used that descriptive of kicking life in the ass when it needs it, right, is Don Miguel Ruiz from The Four Agreements. It's a beautiful show. So anyway, listen, Gloria, I want to say what a pleasure. I mean, I really, truly look forward to our emerging friendship. I look forward to helping in any way I can as you step out onto these stages around the world. And I look forward to your book and spending time with your stories. I believe that you're really on a path to impact millions of people with this message. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Wow. So what a wonderful career Gloria has had, to have touched so many lives in so many different ways, and really kind of put yourself out there as a celebrity and a philanthropist your whole life. I think it's unbelievable. Anyway, a couple things, couple notes before I let you roll. On the Facebook page, which again is, you can get to it by going to davidonfacebook.com. See how easy I make that for you? Davidonfacebook.com takes you right to the Kick-Ass Life Facebook page. I've put a poll on there because I want to find out how people are listening to the show. So do you listen to it on your iPhone? You know, do you have like a subscription with the podcast application? Are you listening to it on the Kick-Ass Life website? There's a million different ways you can listen to the show. So I would love to know how you are listening to the show because we want to better suit your environment. So if you're, you know, if everybody's listening to it one way or the other, we want to make sure that we are addressing how you're listening to it and give you some really cool, you know, experiences because we're catering the show to those experiences. So if you can, pop on over to davidonfacebook.com. And check out the poll and just click how you like to listen to the show. And then write a comment if you would, okay? So that's it for now. Thank you for all of your ratings and reviews. They really help us stay relevant. You know, we want to stay top 10, but, you know, I know that's not always possible. But we do thank you for that. And you all go out there and have a kick-ass day. We'll see you on the other side. Bye-bye.
That was kick-ass.